Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance, with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance, neath the cover of October skies.
What's up? What's up, everybody? Welcome aboard to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horwitz, and as I promised, I'm bringing back the Badger, because we got a lot of ground to cover, Badger. And, you know, I'll tell you one thing, you know, we look around the markets, and you and I talk about this stuff all the time, and do it for clients, the hedging of a portfolio, the protecting. You know, you and I both know that markets themselves, we've had an unbelievable run, you know, 200% from the bottom. And, you know, if you were able to withstand all the browbeating and the money loss, and you held out, you're obviously a very happy camp right now. Some were able to, some were not able to. But, you know, we've seen over the last, you know, couple of years, hedge funds kind of struggling a little bit with these markets. What do you think? What are you seeing? And what are some of your answers to what's going on?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, of course, the hedge funds run billions of dollars of money, and they're going to go where they think that the big edge is going to come in, right? So they can do anything. I mean, they can buy dollars, they can sell yuan, they can buy oil, they can sell natural gas, they can do anything they want. And what they feel is that over long periods of time, that they can outperform the market indexes. Well, some guys like Warren Buffett don't believe that's the case. He believes that they can't. He thinks that fees are too high, and that they can't overcome those fees and get the same returns as you can in the index market. You know, I'm not sure that I agree with Warren Buffett in that. Some of the hedge funds, if they can hedge their way out when these bets start to go sour, you know, they can get the good side of it, and they take a bit of beating on the bad side of it, but not so bad. I think that's really one of the things that they did. Last month, of course, they reported their worst month in years after having a spectacular first quarter. But let's think about what happened in the first quarter and why these guys are got such spectacular returns. First of all of them had bet on the dollar, right?
Right.
Okay, in the previous 6 months, the dollar went up 30% against the euro, went up more against other major currencies. And so these guys, you know, they just had the spread on. I mean, they were long dollars and short the foreign currencies. They couldn't possibly go bad. But then suddenly, right in the middle of the month, I think that the dollar lost, 6%?
It lost 5%. It hit a high of like 100, okay, or a dollar. I don't know how you quote that, but it hit a high of 100 and then broke back down to 95, 94. And that seems to be a pretty good level of support. But of course, they're going to take some punishment when that happens, because obviously the markets went down.
Well, it was very quick too. I think it was 10 trading sessions. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a slow grinding market that, you know, such as what's happened in the stock markets, where they've just been grinding up 0.25%, 0.5%, and then they give back 0.25%, gain 3%. So it's not like that. It was a big, big blast. And of course, they've been short energy, right? So they've been short crude oil for months, and they made just enormous profits. But they didn't count on the fact that in April, crude oil had its biggest year or biggest month, I think, in percentage wise. In years,
forever, and forever,
40%.
Yeah, and forever, so we see that, you know, the way that they work is they're trying to ride high with whatever's hot. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I agree 100%. That's why they're called a hedge fund. They're not an equity fund. They're not a mutual fund. They are allowed to invest in anything with their clients' money, provided their clients have approved. And they're required to keep their money in so long with the fund, and then they can take it out. And one thing's, you know, even the best traders that have ever lived don't always make money. I mean, even the legends.
Well, like, not, but you always make money, don't you? You never lost money. You're a legend. You never lost money.
I'm a legend. Yeah, I'm a legend in my own mind. Anyway, but as an example, Carl Icahn's fund, even though it had that gigantic position in Apple and God knows how many billions made, Yeah. They actually lost money in 2014.
They lost significant money in 2014, is correct.
They did in relation to the market. Yeah, I think he lost like 8%. You know, and Warren Buffett, one of the greatest investors of all time, and you like to use this, you like to use this as a story when you're talking to people. And the reason that Buffett was able to hang on, he took a horrific beating in 2008. He lost 40% of his net worth. The thing is, he had so much money behind it that he was able to, you know, cash out of stuff and then rebuy other assets, primarily equities, and he got it all back. So, you know, this is something that you have to realize, that the hedge funds are always looking for a way to limit risk. Limiting risk is the most important single thing. You know, we teach people, the first thing we teach them is about micropsychology and how you handle risk, what it's like emotionally when things are going wrong and you're losing money. Until you've ever actually been involved in that situation, you don't know how you're going to react. I can tell you that. And so the first thing you want to do is, when you're doing something like this, you got to believe in Murphy's Law. The more complex a system is that you are using to create money, the more complex the strategy, might be the best system possible. But you have to have a back door. There has to be a way that when things start to go bad, and as you well know, Bubba, things will always find a way to go bad, you got to be able to get out. And, you know, we think that one of the things that we think we can do now with the way the weekly options have taken off, we believe that the opportunity has come. If you're willing to give up a little bit of your upside and you don't let greed get away with you, but you don't want that feeling when you wake up in the morning and, you hear something like tanks roll through the streets of Moscow. I'll never forget that morning. You hear that noise when you get up, you know, oh, there's been a plane crash at the World Trade Center. So this, the feeling that you get financially when you have that, if you have your positions hedged out to a great extent, you may give up some of your upside. If the market goes up 200%, you might only make 140%. However, if the market opens up down 30%, you're going to lose a little tiny bit of your money.
Right. And I think that is, you know, it's always important, especially, again, we're not, I mean, the truth of the matter is I would personally like to be hedged all the time, because then you never have to worry about the downside. And when it happens, you actually, when it does happen, you actually have more funds to accumulate more assets at lower levels. But at the end of the day, you know, again, if you're in the market as an investor, this is not a trader, as an investor, it makes sense to be in that position, because you can sleep at night and you don't care what news you hear over the weekend or overnight of what happened, because you know that you're relatively well protected, especially for those of you who are looking and collecting dividends. Okay, because one of the biggest fallacies in investing is, well, you know, let's get the dividend. All right, you know, and right now everybody's talking, well, you know, I can buy this stock, it pays a 5% dividend, and the 10-year is only paying a 2% dividend or a 2% rate. I go, okay. But of course, what everybody forgets is that when you get a dividend from the company, you're paying yourself the dividend. It comes directly from the price of your stock. But not only that part, but the other part of it is that if the stock goes down 30%, how good was that 5% dividend that you were getting? It wasn't very good, right? I mean, it's a guaranteed dividend pay, but it's not a guaranteed profit, right?
No, it's not guaranteed at all. You do get a dividend, and of course, we call those defensive stocks. But, you know, when you had a meltdown like happened in 2008, and we can cite at least 20 meltdowns similar to 2008 over the past 60 or 70 years, what you're going to find out is that, yeah, that's a good strategy, but is there a better strategy available? And we believe that hedging. Now, some people say, well, hedging is expensive. I don't want to do that. We're saying, well, it's not really that expensive. And depending on the market action, the hedge can actually make you money while you're sitting and churning around. And people don't have the slightest idea that's possible.
We're going to talk about that when we come back from the break, because you just said some things that are really important that most people don't understand, that you can actually, there are times when you will outperform everything with this particular hedge on. But you are listening to The Bubba Show with Bubba and Badger, and we're going to step out of here for a break, and I want to make sure you check out thebubbashow.org and check out the new Bubba report that is out. It's ready to go. It's $99 a year. Check it, click it, get it, because you got to have it. It's the best. This is The Bubba Show. Todd Bob Ward's. We'll be right back after the break. The Bubba Show. Right, turn off the lights. We're going to lose our minds. Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz hanging out with the Badger, and we're hedging our lives away. And one of the things that, you know, one thing that bothers me, Badger, before we talk about the hedge, is why is it so important that everybody benchmarks against the S&P when the stock market is, what would you say, the seventh biggest market in the world?
Oh yeah, you know, I mean, there's nothing is bigger than fixed income. We know that fixed income just dwarfs everything. And the stock market, the U.S. stock markets or the foreign markets, you know, if you take all of those together, they don't total anywhere near probably 10% of the equity markets. I mean, I'm sorry, of the debt markets, of the commodity markets. I mean, these markets are very, very, very big. Yeah.
You know, so and then we look at, you know, quietly the endowment funds, you know, the endowment model used by many of the universities, you know, you never heard them whining during the collapses because they just consistently invest in very wide diversified. I mean, they're in the equity markets. They're everywhere, but they're everywhere and they're usually marked up pretty well. And, you know, they just keep grinding and grinding and grinding. But for those who don't or don't have the money, obviously, you know, none of us all have a lazy couple of billion laying around that we can do all these different strategies with. And we have to kind of pick our poison. You and I look at the, you know, the equity markets and the commodity markets because, you know, markets that have options on them are easily hedgeable and you can take care of yourselves in using those types of positions on those markets. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's a lot of ways to do it. Obviously, the market has to be liquid. You can't go into a market that has no liquidity and try to hedge it. But then we always tell people we deal with them, we teach them, you have to stay away from illiquid markets. So liquid markets are terrible. They're the Roach Motel. And once you're in, you're going to find out exactly what we're talking about when you try to get out. So we want people to stay away from those particular problems. That's number one. Number two, if used properly, like you said earlier, hedging can be used in any market. Now, the classic hedge was one of two things. The classic hedge was what we call the collar. And the collar is very simple. You buy a put and you sell a call. The premium in the put, for those that are not familiar with options, options have air in them. And that's just like, that's what, how they determine the other side of the trade. You know, when AIG collapsed, what are they really doing? They were selling naked options. They were selling naked options against the mortgage debt. And, you know, when it came out in the press, it sounded like they were doing some sophisticated, horrible strategy. There was no sophisticated, horrible strategy.
It was just a horrible strategy.
it wasn't sophisticated. It was just horrible. And what they did is they just way, way underestimated how bad the market could melt down. And the premiums they were charging weren't nearly enough to cover it. And, of course, everybody had to get out the same door, right? Goldman got out first, and they got paid. But the rest of the guys couldn't get out, and they eventually did get paid by the government, but except for our friends at Shearson and Bear Stearns. So my point is that there are ways to hedge. The problem with that particular kind of hedge, and the reason we don't use that hedge, is it limits your upside. You have no upside, period. You own the stock exactly where it is. Now, if you're saying to yourself, listen, I don't care if the stock triples in price. All I want to do is I want to be sure that I am long the stock here. That's a strategy to use. We wouldn't recommend it, but it is a strategy. The other strategy that has been popular for many years is to sell out of the money calls. You know, when there weren't as many options, I shouldn't really say that, should I? When there weren't as many techniques available in the derivative market as there are now, that was a strategy a lot of people used. The hole in that strategy is two things. One, if the stock did go to a million, you collected the premium, so you did sell your stock at a higher price, but then the stock was called away from you. Secondly, and what most people found out, unfortunately, in 2008, is that you have limited protection to the downside. So that call that you sold, the air in that call, gives you a little protection. So you might be able to hedge yourself down to 1% or 2% of the value of the stock, depending on how you write the call. Unfortunately, if the market absolutely collapses, you really have no protection whatsoever. You first 1 or 2% you're protected, and the rest you just get killed. A third popular strategy is just simply to buy puts. Now, when they talk about the cost of financing, This is what they're talking about. If you want to be hedged in, you can just buy puts. And then you take the price of the stock where it currently is, you subtract the strike price, and you subtract the error you paid, and then you're protected from that point down. If the stock goes to zero, you're fine. If the stock continues to rally, the amount of premium that you pay to get into your hedge is then deducted from your profit, depending on how long you did that. Now, people that write options, the professional market makers, they're pretty bright guys, and they're only going to sell you those options when the market's going down if they can do something against it. And you know, Bob, as well as I did, what happened to people that actually were trying to buy puts to protect themselves at the bottom of the market in 2008 when guys on TV were saying, this is it. We're going to zero. We just get rid of everything. Get rid of it. Don't think about it. Just dump everything and you'll be fine. Well, a lot of those people dump their stocks by buying puts. You want to tell them what happened on those people that bought those puts when the market continued to go down?
Yeah, they're still looking for those people because they all went bust because they so overpaid for that right that the numbers never could work out.
Never.
And that's the problem. See, this is the problem when you listen to people that don't have no idea. The option model is a simple model. But people like to try to make it complex and like to show how much they know. But at the end of the day, there is no such thing as a cheap option, call or put. They are always fairly priced unless there's one occasion when they're not fairly priced and that's when they're expensive. But I can guarantee you, I guarantee it, as my dad used to say, that nobody is going to give you a discount on options. This is not Carson Perry Scott where they have a coupon. You're going to get something cheaper because if you remember and take this to the bank that there's always somebody on the other side of your trade, okay, believe me, the guy on the other side, he's the same as an insurance actuary and they don't give nothing away, okay? So if he's selling it to you, you can bet that the option you are buying is either fairly priced or overpriced, but never underpriced, especially as a retail trader, correct?
Yes, as a retail trader, it is never underpriced. It could be fairly priced. Remember, your market makers don't have a lot of the problems you do. They don't have commission. The market makers are looking to lay off their risks so that when they're buying something or selling something to you, they found an area that they believe they can go and eventually get out of the trade. It's not as good as the boys in the bellies anymore where you make money on both sides. But if they feel that they can get out of one side of their trade and give up some of that edge, they're going to take that and they're going to go right to the other side of the trade. They rely on making their money based on volume. When they're buying one thing, they're trying to sell another thing against it. They are running their own hedge because they couldn't possibly take on the rest of the world unless they themselves had a hedge. So, you know, one of the reasons or one of the ways that we've been able to define hedging a little bit better, and we think we have a really, really sound program, is that's what we did. We had to take the other side of the trade. The other side of the trade was not mom and dad, or the dentist from Peoria, as my buddy Jerry Siegel used to say. The other side of the trade was going to be Goldman. It was going to be Merrill. It was going to be Bank of America. It was going to be Swiss, Credit Suisse.
Or Chicago Corp that are out of business. Or Shearson Lehman that's out of business. Right.
they have also the other side. Drexel was the other side. So there were some guys that screwed up a little bit, but we didn't worry about that. We couldn't know who that was, and we had to take make sure that we were going to be back the next day if the world came to an end. And believe me, if you traded long enough, I can tell you for sure, out of nowhere, the world could suddenly come to an end.
And but the badger is saying here, by the way, is that these guys weren't coming in to buy ones and two lots, okay?
No.
They were coming in, and actually it's funny because they got more sophisticated as the years went on because, you know, initially, you could see the broker, right? He was itching. He knew he had a big number in his hand, right? He couldn't wait to unload it because he didn't want to get stuck with it, right?
But, yeah, he would do the dance.
But eventually, they got smarter as well because they started to send in small forces. You know, instead of bringing in the entire armed forces, they would bring in small little battle, little infantry, little stations and get to you that way. But we're going to pick up more of this after the break because this is a lot of people don't understand this. And this ties into, you know, what's going on in the interest rate market as well. And it just, you know, not everybody understands it. I think it's important that you, the guy out there on the street, you know, because nobody's ever going to be able to explain it to you the way that we're going to share with you how these things work and why it's happening and how you know certain things are about to happen. This is the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. I'm hanging out with my man, the Badger. And again, we want to remind you to check out the Bubba Report. The May issue is out, and that has writing from the Badger, myself, Bonnie Pittenger, Scott Shalady, Keith Bliss, and Mike Brown, all over 200 years combined in the business, or in which we can help you be better. This is The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horwitz will be right back after the break. The Bubba Show.
Trust. For nearly four decades, that is the reputation Roberts & Roberts Brokerage has forged with their customers. Now, with their full e-commerce website, rrbi.co, it's easier than ever to buy or sell precious metals via Bitcoin or major credit card. Visit them online at rrbi.co or call 800-874-9760 to speak with an experienced professional today. Roberts & Roberts, when you're serious about precious metals.
What's up, everybody? Bubba here. It's finally here. The long-awaited Bubba Report, bringing you news from all the trading floors across the globe. We've got Scott Shalady, the cow guy, as seen on CNBC, Fox, and Bloomberg. We've got Keith Bliss, CNBC, Fox, and a floor trader at the New York Stock Exchange. We've got the Badger, who writes the hot topics in the political news. We've got myself putting together my own unique indexes that will help you give you a better idea of what's going on in the market. All you need to do to get a hold of the Bubba Report is go to thebubbashow.org and sign up for the newsletter, or you can email me direct at bubba@thebubbashow.org. We want you to have this report because we've got over 150 years of experience talking about markets, getting ready for the trading, and puts you in the best position to have successful. So email me at bubba@thebubbashow.org to get a copy of your report, or go right to the website, thebubbashow.org. Make sure you get it. It's a must-have for every investor and trader. The Bubba Report. Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horwitz hanging out with the Badgers. So Badger, you know, we were talking, you know, about, you know, how these orders and how they became a little bit more sophisticated and would bring in little guys in and start buying and buying. But before you knew it, they were buying thousands. And you were sitting there, yeah. What truck just ran over me? But again, that's why there is no such thing as a cheap option. And this is an important concept for you to understand, because if you think you're getting a value, you're not. The best you can hope to do is pay fair value. You agree?
Yeah. That's the best you can hope to do. And we know the reason we concentrate, when we trade option, we concentrate in the options at the money, because we know that's fair value. That's where the underwriter, that's where the market makers are willing to buy and sell the option. It's all premium. It's all air. So since the option's all air, they're not going to really want to overpay for that, and they won't. And they're not going to want to sell it if they're selling it. So what they feel is, in their price model, their pricing model, that if you're trading the at the money option, then you can price all the options off that. Now, that may seem crazy, but if you've been doing this a while, you find out it absolutely works every time.
Absolutely, because every option has a relationship to every other option, except when you get way away from the money, they get a little goofy. But still, at the end of the day, they have to have a relationship, but they just don't always during the day when you're seeing it. But you'll never get advantage. You'll never get the edge as a retail trader. It's just not meant to be, because you don't pay the fees and own the membership and everything else it costs to get that advantage. But that's fine. We don't need the advantage to do what we're doing, but we'll disclose more as we go by. But I also wanted to get in today, Badger. You know, there's a lot going on. First of all, in the bond market right now, I know you're watching it. You watch it every day like I do. And of course, it's been really wacko, and the bonds themselves are telling you that they are looking for a rate hike. They don't care what anybody says right now, but there's a lot of tricky things that go on throughout, you know, there's, they call them duration weighted spreads. And of course, you and I traded the fight and the knob and all these different types of spreads that, you know, mean anything right now to the audience. But let's get into what this is all about.
Yeah, well, I mean, fixed income, as we talked about earlier in an earlier segment, is far and away the biggest segment of the securities market. I mean, it's not even close. Debt is thousands of times bigger than equity. Just think about it when you look at it. All your houses have huge debt on them. That's a debt market. Forget about the equities and that. But it's the equity in the house, the amount you could sell your house for over what you paid for it, or if it's a short sale, the amount under. But what we're going to talk about here is if interest rates are going up and what that means. So it's very important that you understand this, because a lot of people, this is how they get whacked out. And they get themselves in a position where they don't understand the relationship or the duration of the spreads. Okay, so very simply, it's like this. Fixed income is a inverse relationship. As the yield goes up, the price comes down. As the price comes down, the yield goes up. They're automatic. Now, a lot of things people don't get, they get confused about is the difference between market value and maturity, or the face value of the instrument. And the way those instruments work is they go out in time, or what we call duration. The relationship of the price goes up and down. When we talk about an income, we talk about the yield curve getting flat and the yield curve getting steep. When the yield curve's flat, your duration weighted spreads are basically trading at the same price. So, you know, the Fed has flattened out the yield curve. Now, yes, it does go from 25 basis points to where the 10 years, what did the 30-year close at today, Bubba?
The 30 years at just over 3% again, by the way. And the 10-year in the middle is at 2.27.
Yeah, so that yield curve is fairly flat. Back when 30 years ago, when the yield curve reached unbelievable proportions, when the 30-year bond, and people absolutely do not remember this unless they were alive then involved in it, the 30-year bond, the U.S. government treasury bond, was yielding over 10%, which means you could have bought that bond, and for the next 30 years, you were guaranteed 10% on your money if the bond didn't appreciate. Now, in those days, the long bond, as we call it, the 30-year treasury bond, when its yield reached over 10%, the dollar value or the market value of the bond cut in half. It was trading in the 50s. So that meant if you bought a U.S. treasury bond when interest rates 4 or 5 years earlier were at 5%, the face value of that bond remains the same. And so let's say you bought a $10,000 bond. If you bought a $10,000 bond at 5%, but you wanted to go and you wanted to cash that money in, you weren't going to get the face value of the bond. You're going to get the market value. And when interest rates went through the moon, the price of the bond, it collapsed. There was nothing wrong with the quality. There was nothing, the U.S. wasn't going broke. I can still remember, in those days, we really didn't have cable TV, but I remember guys in the radio talking about the fact that that these bonds have become dangerous. Well, the bonds themselves weren't dangerous at all. They were AAA rated. It's the face value stayed the same. The market value collapsed. And as we go into this phase, if the Fed starts to raise interest rates, unless you understand the difference in a duration-weighted item with bond prices now just soaring, we'll explain all that, how that goes out in time, you can get yourself in a heck of a mess here. There was always the saying, stay short, which meant if interest rates are high, you wanted to make sure you didn't have all that money. If interest rates were very low, you didn't want to have all that money out there 30 years. People would make a very bad mistake, and they would go out and they'd buy 30-year bonds that were yielding at that time, which seems like a lot, 6%. And then suddenly the market would go bananas. We were having the inflation. We were having all the problems. And their bond was, well, they'd call you up and they'd say, because I dealt in bonds, which I guess I probably should have said. They'd call you up and they go, what happened to my bond? I just saw that the price in the Wall Street Journal, because they used to publish them every day.
Right, I remember that.
On the municipals. And they'd say, it's only worth 83 cents in the dollar. You told me these were really good bonds. I said, they are really good bonds. That has nothing to do with the bond. The bond is still AAA rated. What it has to do with, market conditions have changed, and market conditions will continually change in fixed income. They will change forever. You know, I don't know if I'll live long enough to see bonds up at 7 or 8% again. Could be at 15%. I have no idea where they are, or where there will be. But I can guarantee you, there's going to be a big fluctuation in it. And if you don't understand how that yield spread curve works, you could get a horrific black eye if you buy the wrong maturities, particularly at this time with ultra-low interest rates.
Right. So let's go through the process and walk us through, first of all, where they start, because they actually have, there's notes, bonds, and bills. Explain right to everybody how that really works.
Yeah. Well, there's key markets, and depending on what country you're trading in, they have a name for it. You know, the Bund, the Schnauf, the Bubble. If you're trading German, you know, the long bond in Great Britain. I haven't traded them for so long, not to gilt. But what's the long bond?
Hell if I know. I don't remember.
Okay. I traded them. Anyway, the point that we're trying to bring up is here, you have to understand which category of interest that you're buying. Bills generally mature in 1 year or less. So you hear the term, it's a T-bill. Well, that's what that is. It's a treasury bill. And that generally has a maturity level of 1 year or less. Then you go out to notes, and notes will typically go in the U.S. because if you're buying U.S. debt, you're buying 2, 5, and 10 year. And that's called your note cycle. Now, if you can see, as you go out further, you're going to notice, generally speaking, the further out you go, the more you get return because more things can happen, right?
They're in contango.
What?
They're in contango.
They're in contango, yes. They are in contango. You don't want to be trading backwardation, although that was great when we had that back in the mid-80s. Anyway, so what will happen is that yield curve will go out, and it'll be at a certain degree. It'll be fairly flat. It'll be steep. The curve will get steep depending on what people anticipate. And then you go to the big one, which is the 30-year bond. Now, believe it or not, as crazy as this would seem, if you remember the 2000 election between Al Gore and George Bush, one of the big points of contention was what we were going to do with all the extra money. You remember that, Bubba?
In 2001, you mean?
Yeah.
I thought it was 2011. I wasn't sure, but it doesn't.
No, 2000. The 2000 election.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Of course I remember. Yeah. What are we going to do with all that extra cash that we have?
Huh?
What are we going to do with all that extra money?
Exactly. That's what they were arguing about. And in fact, it got so crazy that they decided to do away with the 30-year bond. Yeah, we didn't need 30-year bonds every month from now on. We have so much cash. We got so much money. The country's being run so well that we're going to be able to get most of our borrowing very quickly in the form of treasury bills. We're not going to ever need to go out more than 10 years. Well, you know, now, and we're going to talk about that in the next segment, we're going to talk about what happens when they can't get the money they need in 10 years. Why they have to go out 20, 30 years so that they can get more money and that they can get the big investors involved.
That's right, because nothing is ever as it appears. There's always something behind it, and there's always something behind that mirror. And you better learn to realize it and understand it, because as we continue to say, nobody gives nothing for nothing. So you have to realize that, because that's all part of what we're going on right now. Anyways, this is the Bubba Show. I'm with the Badger, and we're talking. We've been talking hedging today, and we're now talking bonds, and we're talking about how they're weighted and what the whole yield curve cycle means. Because it's not important that you master it, but it is important that you have a base understanding of what it is and what it does. So we're going to come back and talk more bonds after the break. This is The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horwitz with The Badger. We will be back right after the break. The Bubba Show.
A man walks down the street. He says, why am I soft?
Welcome back to The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horwitz hanging out with The Badger. So Badger, as we look at the yield curve, and we talk about the curve, and there's terms, and you know, you talked about earlier, flat yield curve or flattish, which, you know, obviously the difference in rates is very small, which is one of the reasons that, of course, banks aren't really lending much money now, because there isn't enough of a spread, there isn't enough of an advantage for them to take to loan it to you. But what happens when we get what they call an inverted curve?
An inverted curve is just the opposite. What happens is there's a great demand for money, and it's current. It's right now. So people that want money are going to pay more for the use of that money. And we've seen some unbelievable, and this formation is actually called backwardation. If you've listened to us talk over the years, we talk about contango, backwardation, you know, how they form in the markets. The big backwardation we had last summer in oil, where the front prices were very high, and then they went down steeply, which gave us an indication that there was probably going to be some sell-off. Well, I don't know if we knew it was going to be that big, but we did. Contango is when you have very little demand for the front. Nobody's using it. So the cash, whether it be bonds, crude oil is going to not have as much value right then, so it depresses the front month. So when we have that backwardation happen in bonds, that's the inverted yield curve, and that's where it gets very shallow because the front's higher than the back. The normal yield curve, or the one we talk about, or the steepening yield curve, is where the front interest rates are very low and the back gets higher because of uncertainty. So here's a good way to think about it. You know, the backwardation is caused by extreme demand for money. People will pay anything. I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe Uncle Sam's been dealing with his bookmaker anyway, but they'll pay anything for that money. But here's the other thing about that. No matter how much they'll pay for that money, they know they're only going to pay for it for a very short period of time. You might not remember this. Some of you will remember this. Back in the 1980s, when they were doing the loans, right, that would adjust. They would adjust because they couldn't go out in time. So they were using the adjustable front one. So you would have to pay a little bit more, but it was only going to be paid for a specific period of time. And then you would get another loan that would go out there. So let's look at the typical formation and what you've got to be careful about. Now, if you're holding T-bills, U.S. government T-bills that mature in 1 month, those trade historically very, very close to their face value because they're pulled by maturity. We know that in a month from now, no matter what happens to the rest of the world's interest rates, we're going to get our cash back. And so we can invest that long term if the rates go up. If the rates don't go up, we'll just reinvest it short term while we're waiting. So this is a very, this is called shortening. This is a short strategy. And we do know with a 99.99999% chance that we're going to get our principal back. So if interest rates rise, it's going to have no effect on our market value. Remember, face value remains the same. As long as the bonds don't default, the face value will be paid to you by the borrower. So you don't have to worry about that. The question is, what happens between now and the time the bonds default? Well, we know as you go further out in time, there's more uncertainties. As there's more uncertainties, if you ever like to look at Murphy's Law, you know that I had that famous poster, the guy sitting there stuck in the mud, that anything that can go wrong will go wrong. It's a mathematical certainty. The more complex system, the more risk that's inherent in it. As we extend time, we get a bigger problem. Now, if interest rates rise, it looks like a much different case. So let's say now that we're holding a two-year note, all right? And you're holding a two-year note that returns 0.5%, and interest rates double over 2 years. Now, you might think that you would get killed in your 0.5% note because now you can get 1%. But believe it or not, because you're so close to expiration, although it really would happen, they'd factor in that bond. The bond wouldn't go to 50 cents in a dollar. Your yield would be in the hundreds of percents. The bond will go to maybe lose 2 or 3% of its market value. Again, its market value, the face value remains exactly the same because you're so close to maturity. It's affected more than your treasury bill, which have no effect whatsoever on the face or on the market value. Very little, even if interest rates go up that much, because it's going to be done in 30 days. Anybody can live through that. Now let's look at what would happen, though, if you started to go out further in time. And this is something that's very important to understand, and this is where duration comes in. If you're holding a two-year note and the price of the bond doubles, or I'm sorry, the interest rate doubles, you're going to lose a certain percent of your market value, but you're going to be able to hold on. The longer we go in time, the more dramatic it becomes. So now let's say there's bonds out there that are issued now, 50-year bonds. Some countries, even with very, very good credit ratings, are now issuing 50-year bonds. All right. Now, this is the duration. Let's say that they issued the bond originally at 3%, but interest rates have gotten crushed. The reverse happened. The 3% bond is now trading at, you know, what's with the 50-year bonds probably trading at 1.5%. Well, the market value of that bond would soar. They have tables that tell us how much that would soar to, but it could go up to 200%. I mean, so if you paid $10,000 for your 3% bond, that bond can have a market value of $20,000 because interest rates have soared, but they really didn't soar that much. That's just how much that they, it appears that they happen. let's look at the 50 basis point rise now in the 2-year bond versus a 50-year bond. If interest rates were to go up by 50 basis points, which remember doubled the yield before, but it didn't double it now, that 2-year bond would lose more than 20% of its market value. So if it was worth $20,000 and 50 point basis rate came in, it would now be worth 20% less. So you'd only have $16,000. You'd lose $4,000 of market value. Now, this is how the markets trade. If that bond were to go up all the way to 4%, the value of your bond would fall to 65 cents in the dollar. And you would have to hold those. That's market value, which means it's marked to the market. You would still get your 3% return, but you know, if you were buying a new bond, you could now get 25% more return. 3% to 4% isn't 1%, it's 25%. And the value of that bond, which would come down to say 65 cents in the dollar, as it got closer to expiration, but that's 50 years from now, it gradually would go back up.
Right.
So when you look at the way the bond market works, you have to be sure. You'd say, well, why would people keep their money in such short-term instruments? Because the danger of going out in time to get that more yield is really great at this point.
Well, actually, we used to keep all our trading capital in T-bills, remember?
Yeah, we had to.
Right. I mean, that was where all the money was kept. So it was, you know, and it wasn't, we weren't trying to take advantage of the interest rate. We were just, you know, barking our money somewhere where it was going to be safely held. Right. While we were using it to trade against. But so when you look at this model, now we know that the face value of the bond, if you have to hold it all in maturity, you will eventually get back to that face value, correct?
That's right. That's absolutely correct, provided there's no default.
Well, yeah. I mean, we're assuming I'm more dealing with the full faith and credit here.
Yeah,
so
these are full faith and credit bonds, yes. Full faith and credit bonds, you will get your principal back.
That's but you right. have to wait, and you can't, again, that's why you can't get disturbed during it. Just sometimes it's just like the Fed right now, is it not, that they can just sit and hold these bonds until the maturity if they have to?
Yes, they can. There's nothing to make the Fed, and that's one thing I think I'm getting more and more of the opinion that they're just going to simply make this a 30-year a 30-year QE, that they'll gradually let the bonds mature off their books. A lot of people aren't aware of that. They think that the Fed has to take action to get rid of those bonds. Well, they don't. They're allowed to hold them. I mean, and I think that's probably what they're going to do, or they're going to let them go by over time. They'll let a short amount come back into the market.
They're just like the e-bonds you used to get for your weddings and parties. Hold them for 8 years, and at 8 years, they, or whatever, what was it? It was 25. I don't remember what this was. Whatever it was.
I think the e-bonds were 10 years.
Whatever they were, you held them to maturity, and then you got your interest rate, but you got, you know, they did fluctuate in value, but at the end, if you waited, you did get face value for them. But we hope that this kind of helped clear up part of the picture. I mean, it's not an easy solution, but certainly everybody needs to have just a general base understanding of what duration and what this all means, because you hear it all the time, and most people don't know how to explain it. And I hope we gave you a good general explanation. If you have any questions, as always, email me at bub@thebubbashow.org. Would love to hear from you anyways. And we do get so many questions throughout the week, and of course, I answer each one individually as well as answering them on air. But that'll take us to the end of the day, and it's been always great to spend some time with the Badger. And we will see you back here tomorrow, same time, same station. This is The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. Have a great day, everybody. Thank you so much, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. Good night.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.